We come from the fire, living in the fire. Go back to the fire, turn the world around. We come from the fire, living in the fire. Go back to the fire, turn the world around.
Welcome to Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special program, A Conversation with Harry Belafonte. I'm Ken Nash with Mimi Rosenberg.
Harry Belafonte has been called the consummate entertainer, an artist in every field in which he has participated, a concert singer, a recording artist, a movie, Broadway, and television star and producer. Belafonte's activity in the human rights struggle is globally respected. His awards and recognitions encompass both worlds as artist and humanitarian. He believes that his work for human rights and his artistic pursuits give him the basis for a most productive and balanced life. Neither overshadows the other, and both are extremely important to him. My social and political interests are part of my career, says Belafonte. I can't separate them. My songs reflect the human condition. The role of art isn't just to show life as it is, but to show life as it should be.
A Conversation with Harry Belafonte is a wide-ranging interview reflecting on his life with and views about the labor and civil rights movements of much of the last century. Throughout, Mr. Belafonte, of course, pays special attention to the role of media and media workers in the struggle for social change. And now to Building Bridges, Conversation with Harry Belafonte.
I'll tell you the one part I really particularly loved in here, the quote-unquote backup band.
Oh, Charlie Parker.
No, Max Roach, no, Miles Davis. No, was that really true?
I don't lie.
The very last time that I saw you, you said you had hit 73, and you had expected to be sipping rum on a beach. And, of course, you said this as you were speaking about the possibility of actors and actresses going to jail in relationship to the SAG and AFTRA strike. Clearly, you are not relaxing, and clearly you relate to tremendous numbers of issues of social justice. And why don't we start from that point and go back? What actually are some of your thoughts about the labor movement and the importance of that form of organization? Why the heck should working people be in unions?
Well, I tell you, an awful lot of money is spent to give the illusion and the impression that almost anybody who's involved in the arts, and particularly in the performing arts, are blessed individuals who are doing remarkably well and who are way beyond the limits of mere mortal experience. It's part of the American theme. It's that whole Horatio Alger myth that is, I think, in the hearts and souls of everybody. There's just no way around it. So many of the mechanisms within our society are built to drive home that whole picture that anybody can be an instant capitalist if you just have faith in the system and faith in the great American dream. Artists fall in that category, and I guess are the single greatest victims of this very distorted picture. There's no question that there are some artists who have been able to grab the brass ring and who are hugely overpaid. There are some instances when I would even put myself in that category. I do very well, and a lot of artists do. But the largest majority of people who make up the arts community really live lives that are filled with desperation and filled with anxiety and filled with frustration, and there is no way out for many of them. A bulk of these artists in our union suffer such fate. Most of the members of our union, almost 80% of our union, is unemployed. Those that are employed, only a very small number of those hit that big number that is constantly being publicized as the way it is for all of us. As a consequence, I think people look at artists as an appendage to society, as rather than them being somehow central to society. We are the protectors of culture. We are the interpreters of culture. We are the voice of history. Sometimes we're the only voice in the arts community. And we are relegated to almost the same kind of a dustbin in terms of social affairs, certainly modern social affairs, as our school teachers. Somehow we are regarded as people who are really not central, really not critical to human and social development, and certainly thought. I have grown up in a very long tradition of the labor movement in my earliest years in Harlem during the Depression, during the period of the formation of the greatest moments in the development and the evolution of the labor movement. I was in it as a child, going on picket lines, going to rallies being held everywhere, galvanizing people into joining unions and protecting the workforce and looking for, fighting for, and organizing for better conditions in the world. My father was a seaman, and I remember him going down with Blackie Mayers and the people on the docks of New York City, lending efforts and energies to try to get the dock workers organized and trying to get seamen organized. And my mother, from the Caribbean as a domestic worker, becoming very much involved with Marcus Garvey and A. Philip Randolph and the sleeping car porters and all the things that went on in Harlem trying to get people organized around the issues of labor and fair wages. In my earliest years, when I began to seek employment, when I became an artist, one of the first things I did was to get into the union and to work for the betterment and the development and the growth of our union. All of that wonderful time when the AFL and the CIO, well, they had not yet come together. The Congress of Industrial Organizations was very much southern-based, organized a lot in the South, trying to put together black and white workers around a host of issues that affected the workers in the South. Race and the laws of segregation kept the workforce seriously divided, and the competition between peoples of race was fierce. And we had to get that out of the way and let people understand that it was a device that was to our worst interests and that we should not adhere to the principles of the laws of segregation. Not only were they unjust, but they were immoral, and they were prohibiting us from fully experiencing a life of dignity and a life of a reward for what we did as workers. And the kind of resistance that many put up to the idea that workers organize, it was a brutal time. In the 1920s and 30s. Along comes the war. Everybody kind of puts to rest any antagonisms in the name of the war effort, because of fascism and what was going on in Europe had captured everybody's attention, and it was the most serious affront on the global scene. And no matter what we were doing at home, everybody had to drop that for the moment to get into the responsibilities of trying to contain fascism and, in fact, eliminate it. During the war, the workplace was flooded with workers from all over America because we really needed to produce arms and we needed to produce machineries of destruction and we needed to stay abreast of the war and the instruments that it needed. So everybody kind of got employed. Things were upscaled a bit. But even in those circumstances in the South, black and white workers were not permitted to come together. In the North, it was a little better, just a little. At the end of the Second World War, everybody had huge expectations that the war to end racism, to end fascism, to honor working people, to change the way in which, on a global level, in which the colonialist powers were treating the bulk of the citizens of the world, and certainly here in America. We had expectations that this new thrust to make democracy available to everyone and to eliminate injustice and to alleviate economic oppression was clearly America's mission, especially in the spirit of that period. Everyone who came back and found that no such generosity existed, that America was not about to change the laws of segregation, was not about to look upon the workers in some favorable and meaningful and dignified way, just meant that we had to pick up where we had left off before the war, and that we had to resort to intense efforts at organizing and sustaining our goals and meeting our objectives. In that context, fighting on the racial front to eliminate the laws of segregation, fighting on the labor front to get better conditions for workers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, forced on the scene a huge reaction. And central to that reaction, and the most glaring example of how aggressive the reactionary forces in this country had become, was manifested by the House Un-American Activities Committee and what McCarthy did. And under the banner of labeling everybody unpatriotic, that we were communists, that we were undermining the government, that we were agents for foreign interests, and that we were all hell-bent on the violent overthrow of this government, captured the imaginations of many. That concept was almost universally embraced by the press and those who control mediums of communication. And we had a hell of a fight. The unions were destroyed. Labor leaders were sent to prison. Actors were sent to prison. All of us who were caught in that struggle were brutalized. And we were brutalized not only from the power that came from the private sector, but we were brutalized by those in our government who organized to do just that. It was at that time that I think the labor movement was dealt its severest blow. The purges went way beyond just identifying anybody in the union who may have happened to have been a communist. One would have you believe that almost everybody in unions were communists when nothing could have been further from the truth. All those things that galvanized us to be supportive of one another during the war were now split apart, and new propaganda was flowing into the mainstream of American debate. Those of us in the artists' unions were dealt, I think, the most severe blow. First of all, we had profile. We were in everyone's home. We were household figures. Our utterances were looked upon with as if sometimes we were deity. And people just loved the celebrity of us and the glamour of us and the illusions that we spun in the American social fantasy. And when Joe McCarthy and the House on American Activities Committee decided that to best publicize their cause, they should go after the most popular figures in the motion picture and in the cultural industry, was when our union was dealt its severest blow and it was just dismantled. Many of our colleagues went to jail, some died, others committed suicide. It was a very bleak and a very dark time, not just for our union or our unions in the arts and the crafts, but certainly in the labor movement in the broad sense among workers and miners and transportation workers and industrial workers, the whole schmear. Everybody got crucified. And the labor movement, having been dismantled by that device, has never recovered from it. We're struggling now to come back to a level of decency about how workers are looked upon and treated. We're just now beginning to frame those thoughts and those concepts again in some textual and meaningful way. But it's still a struggle in our union now to get to the point after this long, uninterrupted monologue. And you forgive me, but I never get an opportunity to have this much freedom in any broadcasting institution.
That's WBAI.
I'll have to ask John more often.
And just zip me up when you're ready. Just let me, if I'm talking too long and too much.
No.
We don't believe in sound bites.
Good for you. That's why I listen to you. I mean, I have three radios in my house, and all radios are fixed to the dial of BAI. But in our union, the actors, the cultural workers are in a very difficult time. First of all, the industry itself is in a serious upheaval. The modern technology of internet and website, giving people such instant access to information and to culture and to self-determination about what choices they want to make, that the industry has felt that it is somehow out of control, that it no longer commands the very narrow marketplace by which everyone is required to pass through. Not only those of us who make the goods, but those who come to buy the goods all go through the same very narrow funnel of American American capitalist monopoly of our institutions of culture. The internet is opening it up. Hollywood feels very threatened. The networks feel very threatened, and they're looking for how to cut costs and how to live out this period of difficulty for them. And the first thing that everyone goes after are the workers. In order to fix the profit system, in order to fix interests that people hold, the first thing they go after are the workers. Let's cut their wages back. Let's cut their benefits back. Let's put them in a place where they can be contained and even dismantled, if possible. And that will be our first overture to sustaining our profit and our imperial industrial positions and banking positions. There's a big difference between Harrison Ford and John Travolta and Tom Hanks and the little guy who walks into the office carrying a box of coffee and putting it on the desk. He's also a member of our union. and nobody knows his name, and people will not even remember that they saw his face. But that guy has a wife, and that guy has a family, and he has a place in which he lives, and he puts bread on the table for that family. If both genders in the family are not at work, more often than not, he is carrying the burden. Women carry the burden. Everyone carries the burden in our union because the wages are so slim and what they're paid is so little. We are the last to be considered and the first to be let go when it comes time to talk about where do we cut costs.
What about another element? Where does the issue of race still come in? Why doesn't the sacrifices of the civil rights movement, the sacrifices of the black power movement, the sacrifices of ordinary citizens on a day-to-day basis in poor communities, why have we, or maybe you don't think so, but why have we made in the industry, in our society, so very little progress on the front of egalitarianism for people of color?
I think people have an expectation to see in Hollywood and to see in the cultural community an expression of our social behavior that is contrary to the way the larger society is. When I first walked into the world of Hollywood and I saw what the rules were, what the racial boundaries were, how everybody played out the theme, as wrong and as negative as it was, everybody submitted to it. In my own personal rebellion, as well as the rebellion of my colleagues at the time, we were quite young, we were a new force coming into the mass media. All of those peoples of color who preceded us were the ones who went through the indignity of having to play caricatures. We had to live out the negative concepts that white people said were what we were. We were servile, we were inhumane, we were lesser creatures. Always our presence on the screen in the beginning was displayed this way, with very, very rare exceptions. So I don't want somebody to evoke the fact that they once saw a movie where our image was not that. That was the exception. And Paul Robeson was in one or two movies like that. Oscar Michaud, who was the great black filmmaker of the 1920s and 30s and into the 40s, made films that tried to show us in different light. But by and large, the large popular cultural perception was that we were servants, servile, stupid, ignorant people. When my generation came along, we would not accept roles. We would not accept the relationship with the industry. That would not permit us to be seen differently. That would not permit us to tell our stories in different ways. Because this country was in an ideological struggle with the Soviet Union and the whole issue of communism, and it sought to pass itself off as a great moral, the protector of morality, it had to yield certain, no matter how begrudgingly it was, certain small concessions to us, because the rebellion that the black community was bringing to the table, which was the forerunner to the civil rights movement, those of us who'd come out of the war would no longer accept the laws of segregation, would no longer accept that America could go back to business the way it was in the pre-war days. After all, we just defeated fascism. We just ended the whole issue of white supremacy. And it was the world order. Everybody had new expectations for the last half of the 20th century. But America was not prepared to do that and didn't do it. So we had to fight. And in this fight, America yielded very little, but just enough to give the perception that we were a fully blown democratic society and that we were the best nation on the face of the earth and that all of our citizens were very happy. Well, that little yield was what gave Sidney Poitier, James Edwards, myself, and a handful of people, Ruby Dee, an opportunity to step into the room and try to rearrange the furniture. Hence, Hollywood began to take the lead in saying, we are showing our citizens what and who they really are. And in reality, they were still quite a distance away from permitting us to be who we were and to tell the truth of our history. Until this day, now, the dawning of the 21st century, we still are a people who have never been able to tell accurately, honorably, with dignity, and with great artistic pride the story of our experience on this planet. Through the history of slavery, through the history of the Civil War, through the history of the antebellum period, and certainly in the history of today, we are funneled as a people and as a culture to tell the story that those who control the mediums of communication require us to tell. And nobody violates that code. Nobody. Not Spike Lee, not Denzel Washington. No one. No one violates it. We may think we have made a little headway by some of the things we say and do, but by and large, the containment is still quite severe. In my first experiences with Hollywood, I took a good hard look. I said, you know, Hollywood is really nothing more than a reflection of what the larger society is. They cannot change just by themselves and become some separate colony that behaves differently to the design of the large society. And that what we would have to do to get Hollywood and the cultural institutions in this country to change was to change America, change the government's policies towards us, change the laws that were unjust, get rid of segregation, and that Hollywood would very quickly reflect the mood of the current history, that it would begin to show us as we attack these institutions of oppression and as we change them, so would Hollywood change. And we had this change going on and looked quite promising until in the last 20 years, I would say, when much of the momentum that came out of the civil rights movement began to slow down. People became distracted and preoccupied. Those who were being caught up in the wave of integration, who were now moving into the corporate America and beginning to feel their earliest sense of belonging, abandoned the struggle. Not only abandoned the struggle, but abandoned their communities to go pursue the American dream, which was to get rich, which was to find ourselves as the captains of industry and to begin to play the game as if we were truly equal. And in that context, Hollywood did not have to go forward growing anymore. It didn't have to worry about how much truth it was or was not telling or how much it distorted history. And the colony itself, I think, people assume that if you're not out, prepared to put a rope around the neck of your fellow citizens, that somehow you are devoid of being defined as villainous. Well, just because you're not lynching me doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist. There's a lynching of the spirit. There's a lynching of the soul. There's a lynching of the mind. There's all of this. If you're already contained, your ability to lynch me physically with impunity, since we've changed that, it doesn't mean that lynching is over. Lynching can be defined and applied to a host of other emotions and experiences. And America, I think, still lynches us. I think it still does not give us the capacity and the platform to be able to honorably tell our story and to integrate our history with the history of this country and with the history and experiences of other people so that we become truly equal. Black Americans are required to know more about white America than white America is ever required to know about black America. As a matter of fact, it is almost instinctual that we know what the white man does and how he moves and what his nuances are. Because there was a time when if you didn't read those nuances correctly, you could be dead. And so a people who were required to go through that process develop a character to their culture, a character to their behavior that's very different than the white counterpart. And I think this indifference and this distance and this consciousness that people are prepared to quickly abandon comes to the debate of us is in Hollywood. So that when I can't accuse all the members of the Academy of being actively racially hostile. I think a lot of them are really quite decent people. What their problem is that they're indifferent. What their problem is that they don't feel a conscious need to really make the effort to find out who we are and to find out what our pain and our anguish is about and to see what role they play in that oppression and try to change it. So when you get a guy like Denzel Washington and he does what he does, the members of our academy that vote, they vote to their interests. They vote to the producer they think will hire them the next time. They vote to where they think the industry is going. They try to sustain those mechanisms and those interests. And more often than not, anything black is then left out of the loop. I don't want to get into, did the guy who received the Academy Award for the best actor deserve it, as opposed to Denzel Washington? That's not fair. I happen to like a lot of my colleagues who are white, and I revere them. and we're very close. I think they're very decent people. I think that a lot of them are great artists. How we are treated as workers, there's a vast overlapping between the issues of race and the issues of labor. It is not just the race issue that's involved in the analysis of American life. It is also the class issue. And I think a lot of times people look at racial issues and try to make it a singular thought or concept, when in fact, a lot of times what you look at and call race is really a class issue. And a lot of things that you look at that are class issues you define as race. And I think the two are inextricably bound. I don't think you can really separate them that cleanly. But clearly, those who came up in the tradition of the labor movement out of the 20s and the 30s and the price that we paid for it, those of us who came up through the crisis of race, and those who valiantly led the struggle against inhumane conditions, inspired so many in this nation, and our belief in this country was so unshakable, and for many of us still is. But there's no question that we have had huge reversals, that we sit here in a dilemma on where to go and what to do. We watch the expansion of capitalism globally. We watch the devices and the mechanisms of the World Bank and the institutions of lending, what they have done to the peoples of the developing world in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And if you look at the characteristics of all this stuff and how it moves about in the lives of people, you find that there is always a kind of a central commonality. The guys who are the workers from our union and all other unions who are struggling to maintain what little gains we have made and to even define a better way for the future will find that we are being manipulated by the very same people who manipulate the workers in Africa and the workers in Asia and the sweatshops that hire children and do what they do to young women and all that villainy that hangs out there that we are having such a difficult time trying to cure.
You're listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor reports, Conversation with Harry Belafonte, produced at the studios of WBAI in New York City by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.